Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
It's a dream, so believe it. Now get ready to receive it. There is a peaceful solution. It's called the peace revolution.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast for higher education. Peace Revolution and all the media we create here at Tragedy and Hope is presented without corporate sponsorship and is provided commercial free and free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the members of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard-working media hosts of TragedyandHope.com. I also encourage you to check out the episode notes, references, and links at peacerevolution.org. And therein you'll find an invitation for the Tragedy and Hope online community. I invite you to participate in expediting your learning experience, and the online community has over 30 groups, so it's an easy way to get started in digging into the various lines of study and inquiry into the world in which we all share. Greetings to those of you around the world. Thank you for making time in your busy schedules to tune in, and I'd like to welcome the many, many new listeners and express my appreciation to all of you who've been tuning in over the years as we continue to grow and expand our awareness together. This episode is split into two sections. Metaphorically, it's all one file, but the first section is a roundtable discussion featuring Paul Verge, Rob Christie, Lisa Arborcheski, and yours truly. The topic of discussion is a book titled Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life, by Marshall B. Rosenberg, Ph.D. And the second section of today's episode is an interview wherein Dr. Rosenberg elaborates in his own words. The contextual information we provide in the first section is something that we casually discussed without preparation in the midst of doing some camera testing for the next episode of What You've Been Missing. But I think it's a useful handle to help you get a better grip on the subject discussed in the second section. And with that, I'd like to thank those of you who have embraced this idea embodied by Tragedy and Hope and the online community through the subscriptions and donations, because you are the one who makes all of this possible. And on behalf of everyone else who draws value from these compositions, thank you for taking constructive and meaningful action, for canceling your cable company, and for redirecting your energy to something meaningful. Your inspiration and consistent participation fuels everything we do. This is Episode 17, Nonviolent Solutions for Everyday Situations, an introduction to nonviolent communication. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out. I heard that Maria Heller interviewed Marshall Rosenberg, and I thought it'd be cool to like put that in the podcast. So I emailed her, and I was like, hey, Maria, can I get your interview of Marshall Rosenberg? And she's like, well, do you know when it's from? And so then I did some Googling, and I read like the four pages of Maria plus Marshall Rosenberg. And yeah, it was like 6 or 7 years ago. And so there's no trace of it on the web because her stuff was for subscribers only. And because of that, you know, I don't know. There's somebody out there who has her entire archives, but obviously she doesn't have access or easy access to it because she's gotten screwed over so many times on her hosting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the bottom line is we didn't have any of that to offer.
But it does exist.
The point is, I guess, we are just coming across this in the past, let's say, 6 months, and Maria had interviewed Marshall Rosenberg when his book came out, which was 6 or 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Rob?
Well, I got introduced to, I actually bought all his, the whole package about, I bought his whole package about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. And then, and read some of it, read the stuff about kids, because we were looking at it for, how to raise children, how to communicate correctly with children. Mm-hmm. And, so yeah, we got some of that. I read the smaller ones.
Like pocket size?
Yeah. I've read a bunch of it, but I haven't, it's a lot harder to use.
Yeah. Well, myself, I've only recently come into contact with the idea of nonviolent communication. I'm sure it was referred to by either Rich or yourself, Rob, but, I checked out a bunch of the YouTube videos and gathered as much information as I could and saw the, some of the online material. And I could immediately see the value in terms of at least trying to get an idea across and sort of like dealing with the resistances that come along the way from our previous prejudices, egos, all our different, you know, conditioning and programming. So I definitely, you know, I think we all agree that it's something worth talking about and taking a look at, simply because the outcome, when it's used properly, is usually beneficial for everyone involved.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, like I said earlier, it wasn't until he pulled out the guitar and the puppets that I really got it.
Yeah, it's Hawkins' giraffe language about it. How did you feel?
It felt really good. Felt real good.
Do your chairs only squeak when they're in the, like, not straight up position? Because I just locked mine into position because I could hear Rob's creaking back and forth. Is it when we rock back and forth?
Yeah, it is.
Is it when we do the Rain Man that the chairs squeak? Because I'm sure listeners won't dig that. So for my part, I found out about this nonviolent communication style through the School Sucks podcast, through Wes Bertrand and Brett and these guys talking about it. And then I dug into Complete Liberty and some of the, that's really what got me interested in looking at Stefan Molyneux, was like, he'd come up on the radar so many times, and then I hear him talking intelligently about yet another subject. I was like, all right, I'm going to check this out. And between their coverage of it and then dipping into YouTube and watching a bunch of Marshall Rosenberg playlists, I was, I found a lot of it useful, but I also find a bunch of points that can be improved upon. Not that that's the point of it. It's take what's useful and use it to your advantage. I found, the idea of nonviolent communication to be kind of ironic because it states that all other types of communication are violent. So that's why I kind of presented it as compassionate communication, because that's really what you're trying to do. You're trying to recognize the empathy and compassion in somebody else, such that you can communicate with them on a needs level as a human being, instead of I'm part of this group and you're part of this other group.
Yeah, it's almost like the opposite of divide and conquer, right? It's trying to create uniting and understanding ideas and, you know, viewpoints, so that they see, based on common needs, that there's always a solution that doesn't have to be necessarily a compromise, but can still be win-win when you identify the needs that both parties or all parties have and clearly communicate the feelings associated with those needs.
Right.
So it's constructive conflict resolution.
Yeah.
Well, when you think of conflict, what's the biggest conflict? War. And how does war start?
Miscommunication.
Right. And I think when he talks about when he refers to violent communication, I think what he means is more people either placing blame or judgment, and you don't really get what you're looking for when you do that. It's more of a destructive.
So should we call it conscious or compassionate communication?
Well, I think compassionate includes what you're actually trying to get to, compassion and empathy, which is what is lacking, because it's the dehumanization that lets us just, you know, believe we should start wars with other people because they're different from us.
Yeah, I like empathy personally. Compassion has a potentially
suggest connecting with another person.
I think compassion has to do with pity, but empathetic. Oh. I think that's really. I mean, the thing for me, the thing about the whole thing is that it's the way to stop conflict and all that is when you are actually practicing it, right? So when you're practicing it, like he says, when somebody, you know, comes at him and says whatever, it's all about him just not reacting, not taking anything personally. So it's, so if we can take whatever anybody says, take it as an external thing, not internalize it, try to see what it is that they're saying or empathize whatever it is that they're trying to get across. Or whatever, because we all speak the violent language. We don't even know. I mean, I didn't really get it until I started reasoning. I was like, wow, you know, like.
You are the most conceited speaker ever. That's one of the examples. Somebody says that to him, and he says, well, you know, there's like four different ways I can handle this. I can get upset and tell this guy, no, it's not, or I can do this other thing, or I can actually identify with his needs.
Yeah.
Oh, you have a need to have your voice heard right now. Well, yeah, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think breaking it down, like you're trying to get across your needs, reflect your feelings, but do it in a way that's that's not judgmental, that's, that, like Rob said, is seeking to understand where the other party or parties are coming from, so that you're not just, it kind of requires a bit of consideration. You have to get outside your own needs. Like, you have to clearly identify what your own needs are, but you have to get outside yourself and look at what this other person might value and what they might need, because at the end of the day, although we might maintain that we all have a bunch of different needs for our lives, there's a few core needs that we all need, right? And any conflict that comes up, with the right level of understanding, it's gonna be met with like a happy resolution. So, yeah, needs, feelings, and understanding.
Do we know what the four steps are?
To observe as objectively as you can what's happening in a situation, and to do it in such a way that you're not introducing judgment or evaluation, but rather just trying to understand and see things in terms of, how am I feeling? And is this something that is affecting me maybe in a negative or a positive way? And how is that making me feel?
Well, yeah, in a sense, it's neutral observation, right? You're trying to, the thing, the way that we violently communicate, quote unquote, is by bringing in all our prejudgments, all our past experiences, all our similar experiences. And we're always trying to put, to classify everything into that mold of our prior experience, right? And by bringing that in to any other conversation or communication, it almost loads the conversation with the potential to turn, quote unquote, into a conflict, because the other people that you're dealing with don't always know what you're bringing to the table in terms of your judgments and prejudices and what have you. And those are always going to be like the filter through which most of your communication goes through. So if you take the time through observation to see whether, see how they're communicating and make it not so much a coming to a judgment, but coming to an understanding of how and why they might be communicating in a way, especially if it's supposedly violent coming towards you, right?
Mm-hmm. And then you then would diffuse the situation rather than escalate it.
Yeah, because you'll be detached. If you're observing objectively, you don't have to take it personally, right? And so then through that observation, you can move towards assessing what their feelings are, right? You're observing how they're communicating. You're going to get in touch with their feelings behind the form of communication. So if they're communicating violently, they're probably angry or upset. You know what I mean? If they're communicating very quietly, they might be depressed or sad. And, but you can ask them questions to identify how they view their own feelings. And then based on that, you can boil those feelings down to what needs are fueling those feelings, right?
It almost seems like most of the people that we've encountered lately who seem to be depressed or sad are failing to identify the language in their own thoughts and having that bicameral conversation where they're questioning, like, is this how I'm feeling, or is this how I'm telling myself, like, I'm in an overall situation, and they're almost like reverse engineering their feelings from how they think they should be in this situation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So people who are externalizing and blaming others, a lot of times are failing to recognize that they need to identify the actions, the verbs and the feelings, instead of making these judgments on those feelings and jumping. It's like, there's the formal logic of, if this, then this, therefore this, if then therefore, right? There's a way to go from if this, therefore this, and they skip the middle step.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what's happening, because they're missing the part where they're identifying their feelings and taking it out of context of observation, but they're just adding the judgment on there, and then they're emotionally reacting from those judgments, which are separate from identifying the feelings and the actions associated with those feelings that are causing those feelings, and the lack of self-responsibility over their feelings insofar as, oh, so-and-so hurt my feelings. Well, you gave so-and-so permission to hurt your feelings, so maybe you should take that permission back. Maybe you should not accept them hurting your feelings. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Or coming back to Gatto's, 7
things that he teaches, you know, provisional self-esteem, etc.
Yeah.
Those all seem to kind of tie in.
Yeah, well, you're blaming somebody and then not taking responsibility for your feelings. Blaming somebody else for your feelings. Part of the problem, too, is I think people don't even... Part of it's differentiating needs and wants. So we have to differentiate between a need and a want. And then, like, the whole thing is setting whatever communication you're engaged in, setting up in a way where you're not creating the conflict. Because it's so often, because we've never really been taught how to communicate, because we don't, because of the way that it is so conflictual, you know, like there's so much conflict and competition in the way that we communicate.
So people talking at each other instead of to each other and not listening to one another and trying to prove that they're right and the other person is wrong and judgments and those kinds of things.
Exactly.
Instead of asking yourself, how do I benefit from this exchange? I think we're all bent and conditioned by advertising that make us confuse needs and wants, right? And that was a big thing, like when I was a kid, if I wanted something, I would always be like, dude, I need a new pair of shoes.
Yeah.
My dad would say, "Do you need a new pair of shoes?" And then I'd be like, "No, I know I'm not gonna get them because I have to need them in this house, right?"
Yeah.
Want doesn't matter, and you know that's a strong education that I didn't like when I was a kid, but when I grew older, it's like that's super valuable to understand your wants from your needs, because I know people who think they're the same thing.
Yeah.
Wants and needs are the same thing, and that gets like once it's like once you think wants and needs are the same thing, then the new droid comes out and you gotta have that phone and your kids will go without things they actually need. So you can have this want that you're programmed through this commercial to think you need for part of your provisional self-esteem.
Yeah.
Right?
So it's like, it raises the deeper question about what has led to the form of violent communication or conflictual communication that we have. And it's kind of this domination-based culture, right? I watched the movie True Grit recently, and you know, or watched Deadwood or some kind of show that shows communication as it would have taken place in the late 1800s, and it was a completely different experience. There's still violent communication, but in terms of the way people communicated, there was a little bit more thought and consideration. It was a different form, at least, than what we have today, which is we've almost boiled it down, and because of the consumer conditioning that we've received, it not only makes us domination based in our own desires and actions, but it leads to us confusing the things that we don't really need in life, but through this materialistic conditioning, it gets transformed into what we view as wants. It's really unconscious desires, or even things that can be easily programmed subconsciously. So what you end up with is you're almost defending positions that aren't your own, trying to fulfill desires that are not really your own.
Mm-hmm.
And what this conscious or nonviolent communication, in a sense, almost forces you to do is, like Rich said, ask yourself these questions through the person you're communicating with, and almost turns the mirror on yourself. You have to identify what your real needs are, and you have to identify your feelings associated with it. So in a sense, you have to deal with whatever baggage is there. And what the domination-based communication does is allow us to sort of sidestep the real issues and communicate in this kind of empty rhetoric and never actually get to the root of the matter.
Well, it's still just your fault.
Yeah, because no one has to be responsible when you're in a domination-based culture, right? Everything's it's almost like a manifest destiny. It's just like, well, if somebody gets conquered or slaughtered, it's, you know, if they weren't meant to, then they wouldn't have been.
Yeah, you can justify anything.
Yeah, and so you end up with a lot of, I would say we're a culture of rationalization, you know? And nonviolent communication doesn't really allow you to rationalize so much, because you have to look at both viewpoints, right? Or all three, or however many viewpoints there are. It just forces you to widen your range of consideration.
Well, you mentioned the contrary conditioning that we all receive in the form of education. How do you think the confluence of being denied critical thinking and the fact that we're brought up in a culture that values violent and competitive communication, it's either or instead of also and, how do you think those two kind of coming to a confluence, and what can be done through media to help people become informed in that area?
Well, personally, I think it's the shorthand. It's about creating reactive mindsets, right? Getting people to shortcut past, not even critical thinking, shortcut past thinking, period. And if the powers that be had their way, they would have us either not react would be the first thing. They want us to just be apathetic. But secondly, to react violently and mindlessly, right? And that's why the values that are put across, you know, in popular culture do you promote this kind of violent or domination-based mindset, right? Whether it's the army and football, you know, mixing, or UFC and the army mixing their genres, they're both violence types of things, and they try and blur the line, I guess you could say, to create an association or an anchor. And so if you're communicating media that doesn't start off with a bunch of judgments, that actually communicates an idea, shows multiple sides of it, shows people communicating constructively rather than using fallacies, right? Because a lot of times you'll even watch the news and it's opinion and fallacy masquerading as fact.
Yeah.
And then other people go and commit cynicisms and repeat those quote-unquote facts as if they're truth, and then it just becomes like a house of hoax cards.
Could you compare how this emotional reaction takes hold and how it takes control to somewhat of a metaphor to computers, where you don't have a virus scan, and so anything you download just instantly can take action without you checking it out?
Yeah, well, what I was going to say is that it reflects a lot of the information being done on biology and the way our thoughts interact and our perception and all that stuff, and understanding the whole fight or flight and all that stuff. And basically, because of the civilization that we've created for ourselves, we've got ourselves in a constant fight or flight, so we're always stressed out. So to me, like, the way to communicate with people is to actually get them out of that stressed out mode so that they're not defensive all the time. And the best way I think that we can get across whatever anybody can is that if we can first take the charge over them, because everybody's so stressed out, everybody's so ready to run or defend themselves or whatever they need to do, that it's really hard to communicate anything because they're already in an anger state almost. You know, like when you get angry, you just can't think. You're like, you're punching or you're running, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what I see. Like we're always kind of always in that state. So if we can get people out of that state first, and then try to communicate whatever it is we need to communicate with them, because they're not listening otherwise.
Yeah, they're definitely more receptive when things are relaxed. But in a sense, nonviolent communication is supposed to almost be that first step to disarming an angry or reactive person, because a reactive person is looking to infect you with their reactive kind of virus, right? And if you don't, if you just make it go inert, it kind of blocks off that it kind of melts their sword, as it were, right?
Called verbal jujitsu.
Yeah, verbal jujitsu. But you don't want to put them into a violent hold. What you want to do is just lower their anger vibration, in a sense. You want to disarm the potential violence that they want to use, or not even want to, that they feel they have no choice to use at that moment because they're stuck in the anger state. And your whole goal there is to transform them out of the anger state and into at least a calmer, more receptive state. You don't say that by ordering them to calm down. You do it by getting them outside their own feeling and identifying it from the outside. How do you feel? I'm angry. Hey, we agree. You are angry.
Well, I think that's the really interesting part, because the way you know that you're dealing with a nonviolent communicator usually is somebody says something, and then the person who's supposed to react in a certain way doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
They say this crazy thing that makes you think, and all of a sudden it says, snap, you were emotionally reacting, now I'm asking you questions, what do you got to do? You got to think. Am I feeling these needs? Somebody's actually asking about my needs. Yes, I'm feeling the need for that, right? They totally, you know, it takes, to use a metaphor, it's like in hockey. If you throw the first punch or whatever, a lot of times you don't get caught. It's the person who reacts. It's the person who retaliates after the first strike, because then the referee catches that and you get the penalty.
And you're trying to get to a level of responsibility, right? It always takes two to engage in a fight. Otherwise, if it's one way, it's called assault. So if somebody comes up to you and you haven't done anything wrong and they're just treating you like an asshole, you are making them right by reacting like an asshole. Whereas you can answer them with a question, right? To me, the best shield against an attack is a question, because it immediately puts the attack back in their court, I guess, or puts the ball back in their court and forces them to come at you with at least a different kind of attack or the same kind, whatever, right? But the point would be that it stops them, because they have to suddenly go, well, am I attacking you for a good reason, or am I acting too quickly? But the point, again, is to get them outside of the emotion that's not working to further the conversation.
Well, the whole thing is, usually when you deal with people who are emotionally reacting, those are people who aren't thinking, and the first thing nonviolent communication does is put the ball back in the court and be like, no, you're going to have to think about this, because I'm not going to play your game.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned Stefan Molyneux at the beginning. I think it does tie in with his and Brett Vanat's kind of work, where they talk about the first principles in philosophy of non-force, non-aggression, and non-coercion. And that those kind of are the root principles of conscious or nonviolent communication, because you're not trying to force someone to see your point of view. You're not trying to coerce them necessarily, except through any, you know, negative means. You're trying to bring them about to a level of awareness that's where you're both on par. You're
trying to get them to help see what they need.
Yeah.
They are not even aware, right? You're trying to get them to a point where they understand what it is they're trying to, what they're screaming about.
You're an asshole. I hate you.
And it's like, well, okay. And maybe, but why?
Right? Exactly. And it's by definition pretty much non-aggressive. So.
Well, I was just taking some notes and I was writing down, what is the goal or the point in communicating with someone? For example, in a relationship, the point of attempting to communicate something to someone is because your needs are not being met in some way, or your feelings have been hurt, or what have you. You're making me think about compassionate communication or nonviolent communication with regard to relationships. And the point in a relationship, whether it's a relationship between, you know, brothers and sisters, or parents and children, or if it's, you know, husbands and wives, the point or the goal of communicating with one another is to get your needs met. And if that is the goal, then this nonviolent communication or compassionate communication is the process, the constructive process by which you attain that goal.
Well said.
Look at you.
So, sorry, that was the note that I was writing down.
She just hit a home run and got all three of us back to home base. That's pretty good. That is like the boil down of the point of why we're having this conversation.
Just put that. That's all we needed.
Yeah. Our podcast is 10 seconds long. It's a soundbite from Lisa. That's it. I think part of the whole gaining responsibility for your communication is this journey of self-awareness.
Yeah.
And when people ultimately become self-aware, they kind of have a bubble of consideration that extends beyond just themselves. And they're you know, you start to get a measure of people's energy in the form of their needs, right? You can tell, like, anytime I've stayed with Rich and Lisa, man, it's like they could read my mind. They're just like, hey, you want a glass of water? I was like, I was thirsty. How did you know that? You know what I mean? So there's
but
just,
not like an invasive way.
No, completely voluntary.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why we have the ability to actually procreate.
Yeah.
It's because they're like our little mirrors. So if you haven't realized yourself on your own, you have kids, you're going up pretty quick. You gotta realize that you hate yourself, and that you've got to deal with these little kids that are just like you, and you hate yourself, and they act just like you, so it makes it really hard, because you got to love them.
You got to come to terms. Nature's right? Way of forcing us to come to terms with our own...
Yeah, well, you just watch the way you communicate. Like, when you're dealing with a child, regardless of how they're acting, if you tell them they're acting like that, they just keep on doing it.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to get into an argument with them, you're an idiot.
You're
arguing with a child,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, which, you know, but they just goat you in. They're constantly goading you in to get you to figure out how to communicate.
Yeah.
And you either fail miserably or you figure it out.
Yeah, and all children want to have, like all adults, some sense of control over their own lives, right? So if you can get an adult into giving you their time and energy through any form of communication, your children will go for hours, right? Because they're just like little information sponges.
Yeah.
So you're right. It is a, it's very much a mirror where you're going to learn a lot about yourself. Because again, they're reacting to how you react to them.
Yeah.
And it's a series of reactions, or actions and reactions, however you want to look at it. But it's in who's in control of their reactions. That's where real response ability comes from. It's your ability to respond.
Right, well, they're not supposed to have that, and we are. And so when you start arguing exactly. and escalating it, it's like...
There's a reason why you know,
they're looking at you going, why are you arguing with me? And you're like, ah! And yeah. it's like, wait a second.
Because they're not response-able yet.
Yeah.
still communicate to your children respectfully, but don't expect them to have the frame of reference or the capacity to communicate in such a thoughtful, considerate way back. You can teach them through example rather than through orders.
Right. That's what
you know what I mean? Ordering your child to say
words, punishment.
Right.
Because most parents are dealing with, because they're reading the books and they're being told, you know, through the popular media that the way that you raise your child is punishment and reward.
Yeah.
Your child is Pavlov's dog.
Yeah, well, right. you can't expect them to act any differently than they've seen, right?
Yeah,
that's the thing. They get in trouble for acting what they've learned, which is what they've seen around them, and then they get in trouble for it.
Don't smoke
with the swearing, right? Like they swear.
All actions,
like,
Or when they watch two adults resolve their conflict by screaming at one another and shouting and calling names, or you know. See, letting everything bottle up and then exploding.
Exactly.
And they don't really have good role models.
This was an ad for Jersey Shore.
Of how to constructively express yourself.
How to not.
They have plenty of role models showing them how to destructively express yourself, right. But not so many showing them how to constructively express themselves.
What I think the difference between kids like sopping up information like sponges in adults is that kids have the curiosity and they don't have the pseudo sense of knowledge yet. So they're still curious about how stuff works. But as you get to an adult and you've been conditioned by 15,000 hours of education, you're like, oh, I've already been told how that works. I don't need to look at that. I'm all set with that. Like, give me Seinfeld. You know, let me make some money. I'm all done with learning after all that time in school and in college. I'm all set with learning. I know all that stuff. Let me go make a bunch of money, right? And then you find out, whoa, they didn't give me, I was programmed with the wrong information on purpose, and you want me to pay for that? You don't need to know a college education. If you know how to read, then you know how to be a slave. If you know how to read and think critically, then you can learn how to be a free person. There's no college necessary for any of that.
I started from the question of how come some people enjoy other people's suffering? So that it makes violence enjoyable, so that people find it heroic to punish people that they judge as bad. And then how come other people in the same society are just the opposite? They get their joy not in believing that there's bad people that need to be punished, but they get their joy in contributing to people's well-being. So I then saw that there was quite a different language and quite a different consciousness on the part of people who behaved in the violent way as opposed to the compassionate way. And I decided to try to clarify that. What is the nature of communication that helps us to connect in a way in which we enjoy contributing to each other's well-being? And how is that process of communication different in the people who contribute to the violence of others? Then after I developed nonviolent communication, which is the language and the power usage that I saw contributing to compassionate interaction, I then wondered where the heck did we ever learn this other approach? So then I got interested in where did it all begin, where we learned a way of thinking and communicating that contributes to violence on our planet. And here, scholars and scientists like Walter Wink, the theologian, and his book The Powers That Be, and others who share his perspective, trace this back to about 8,000 years ago when various things happened, I won't go into now, but we came out of it with organizing ourselves in terms of where a few people who claim to be superior dominate others. Sometimes they base their superiority, claiming their family was born closer to God, and so they controlled on the basis of the divine rights of kings. But whatever it is, we started to live in cultures in which a few people claiming to be superior dominated others, and that requires a language of domination. A language in which you classify people in terms of what they are. Are they peons or are they royalty? Are they good? Are they bad? Are they normal? Are they abnormal? That way of thinking goes with domination, because in a domination structure, the people who claim to be on the top claim to know what is right and what is wrong, and they maintain their power through the use of power over tactics such as punishment, reward, guilt, shame. And so they need a language that justifies the use of punishment and reward, the language of retributive justice, in which you make judgments of what the other person deserves. And that is dependent on how you judge them, whether good or bad, right or wrong, and so forth. So that's how I think it all began about 8,000 years ago, when we started to have domination structures in which a few people dominated many. Before that, when we were more in the hunter-gatherer style of society, people that I trust in their studies anthropologically tell me we didn't have violence in the rate that we have since. So nonviolent communication now tries to get us back to what I think is a more natural way of communicating. So I think where we've gotten is an evolutionary snag, where we've gotten stuck on the basis of some unfortunate learning over 8,000 years. And nonviolent communication helps us come back to life, back to a more natural way of living, where our evaluations are on the basis of how needs are served. Are we meeting our needs and the needs of others, rather than who is what? Who's right, who's wrong, who's good and who's bad? No. Are our needs getting met? And if not, what can we do so that everyone's needs get met? That's the language of nonviolent communication. Our training is based on the assumption that the kind of beliefs and judgments that people have that lead them to dehumanize one another and to deny each other's rights, that language, we think, is a distortion of need language that people are trying to say is that our needs are in danger. Some of our needs are in danger. But they're not given a language that helps them to say that. So they go to justifying this on the basis of what their interpretation is of what words were that were written down centuries before. The Bible says, or the Quran says, and they then try to use these documents as justifying that they are right and the other side is wrong. So when I'm mediating between two groups that are thinking that way, who are at war with each other, each time they use that kind of thinking, I translate it into an unmet need. So when I'm working with two groups, such as two tribes that I was working with in northern Nigeria that were at war with each other, and I ask, what needs of yours are not being met? And I'm confident if we can get everybody's needs clarified, we'll find a strategy for meeting the needs of people on both sides. And a chief from the Christian tribe immediately screams across the table, "These people are murderers." And the other people scream back, "These people have been dominating us for 80 years. See, I asked for needs, and they both gave me an analysis of the other side's pathology." Sometimes the analysis takes the form of, our Constitution says, and the other side says, "No, it doesn't say that, it says." Or the Bible says, "No, but the Quran says." So when people are, when I ask for needs, and they immediately go into these intellectual judgments that justifies their position, I translate that into what needs I hear being expressed through that. So when the chief screamed, "You people are murderers," I said, "Chief, are you saying that your need for safety isn't being met?" You see, so I hear the need behind his analysis. And if I guess wrong, he can help me, but I'm looking for needs. but I happen to guess right. That's not too hard to guess what the need might be. He said, that's exactly what I'm saying. Okay. Then I try to get the other side to hear the need. So I said, would a chief on this side please tell me what you heard this chief said his needs were? A chief on the other side of the table screamed across the table, then why did you kill my son? You see, I had been told ahead of time that three people in the room knew that somebody who had killed a member of their family was in the group. So it's not easy, even when you get people to express the needs, it's not easy to see that in the other person when you have these enemy images. So I had to work hard to get the chief from the second side to just hear that. Just tell me, chief, what do you hear him say?
He's saying he has a need for safety.
Okay, just even that makes a big difference, you see. We're out of this intellectual analysis justifying position, and we're connecting at the level of human needs. Then I helped the other side get clear what their needs were and heard by the first side. At that point, one of the chiefs that hadn't said anything jumped up and said, if we know how to speak this way, we don't have to kill each other. You see, it didn't take long, even in this culture, this one chief at least, to see that if you can just talk about your needs and not into this analysis of who's right, who's wrong, we can solve anything. So we not only have to get one side to say clearly what's alive in them, what needs of yours are not getting met, then I have to get the other side to connect with that. And that's not easy, even if it's a simple message, because if the other side's brain has been programmed to be diagnosing the pathology in this person, even if I've said this person says he has a need for safety, I had to ask that person at least three or four times to repeat it back after I repeated it, because his first reaction is, then why did you kill my son? And then the next one was, you can't trust these people, they'll say anything. And then it took a while before I could give him the understanding he needed to be able to just hear the simple phrase, a man said he has a need for safety that isn't being met by the way some of the conflicts are being dealt with. Whew, that took a lot of work just to get that far, but once I got there. So the empathy is the second party seeing this other person's humanness. And the way we see the humanness is by seeing the needs without these enemy images clouding that. It's not easy to do that. It requires full presence to what is alive in this other person. We teach people how to hear the needs on two parts of ourself. The one part of ourself is that part that evaluates what we do. Every action we take, we need to evaluate it about whether it meets our needs or not. If I cook a meal for myself, I need to evaluate, did that meet my need for nurturance, taste, and so forth? And if it didn't, then I want to change that. So whether it's something I did for myself, or if I say something to another person, sometimes it doesn't meet the needs of mine, so I need to evaluate it. Now, how do I evaluate it? If I evaluate it by attacking myself, I say that was a stupid thing to do. We instead suggest to people that you evaluate what you do by whether it met your needs or not. You'll find that you can learn better without losing self-respect if we can learn from our mistakes by being conscious of what need wasn't met to begin with, and then to understand another part of ourself. What need were we trying to meet by doing what we did? So that's the same process I was saying using between two groups, but I'm using it within myself, between two different functions within myself. The function that evaluates what I do, the function that chooses to do what I do. And if I evaluate them in the way I was educated to evaluate, I'd say to myself, that was a stupid thing to do. How could you do something so dumb? And then if I look at the other side of myself about why I do it, well, I had to do it, I had no choice. It denies responsibility. And I can have that going on within myself forever. And if I do, I'll have a lot of depression, guilt, and shame, and it will be very hard to learn from my human limitations. But if I can see the truth is I didn't meet this need of mine by what I did. What need was I trying to meet? Oh yeah, I was trying to meet this need. Well, it met that need, but it didn't. The way I did it didn't meet this other need. Okay, how do I get both needs met? If I can think in terms of needs, I'm far more likely to learn from my limitations without losing self-respect. In our training, we suggest to people that we look at what causes things like depression. We look at it in a way other than to think that it's because there's something wrong with us that we get depressed, that it's a mental illness. We have reasons for worrying about the whole concept of mental illness. We think that some people who we call mentally ill, they have some physical problems that affect their thinking and their chemistry, so that they think that they're something they're not, or they think that people are trying to attack them that aren't. So this can be caused by some physical dysfunction, and I wouldn't want to call them mental illnesses. I would want to say the person has a neurological or a chemical imbalance or something. These are the smallest percentage of people who get labeled mentally ill have those kind of problems. The others, I think it's a very unscientific term to use, mental illness, but worse than unscientific, by making it seem like people have something wrong within them. We don't look at what really contributes to things like depression and to the kind of violence we have on the planet. Our understanding in nonviolent communication is that people get depressed, very depressed, because of how they're trained to think, how they're educated to think. And they get stuck in this thinking, and depression is the result of it. So we don't see it as an illness. We, with people that have that, we try to help them become conscious of what you're telling yourself that's making you so depressed. And then we show them how what you're telling yourself, the judgments you make of yourself, simply are resulting because a need of yours hasn't been met. And unfortunately, we haven't been educated to get connected to the need. So when that need isn't being met, you go up to your head and start blaming yourself, shaming yourself, attacking yourself. And the depression is an inevitable result of how you think about yourself. So we show people how to transform that thinking about themselves into a language of life. If you say, I shouldn't be depressed, or there's something wrong with me for being depressed, which is what we give the idea to people, that you're mentally ill if you are depressed or you have bipolar illness. They now not only have the results of this thinking that makes them depressed, now they think there's something wrong with them for being depressed, so they're doubly depressed because they're judging themselves for judging themselves. So we say, no, there's nothing wrong with you that you do that. You think that way because you were trained to think that way. Now, there's some beauty in it. If you can see the need of yours that wasn't met behind that, you can learn from something. You can better meet your needs. But if you don't get connected to the need of yours that isn't being met, you just stay up in your head saying, I'm a failure, I'll never amount to anything. Or you ask yourself unanswerable questions such as, why did I do that? When you really know the answer, you're already telling yourself, I did it because I'm a failure, I'm a loser. So if you just communicate that way internally, you're going to spend a good deal of your life being depressed. Doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It means you've been educated to think that way. If you take a look at the last 8,000 years through the eyes of Teilhard Chardin, the priest and the paleontologist, he sees a rapid movement back to a more natural way. He calls it Christ consciousness, but my Palestinian friends call it Islam. And anyway, all of them see us as moving back to what is really what we know, that the good life is enriching life, contributing to people's well-being. It's not competing and winning. It's being conscious we're all created out of the same energy. Nobody can benefit at somebody else's expense. So our economy, which is, its success is measured by whether the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, we're coming to see that that's not going to meet anybody's needs. When I ask people all over our planet in my work to think of something they did recently that enriched somebody's life, and everybody can usually think of it, although it takes a while because we every day do so many things that do that. It's so part of us that we don't think of it. You know, we give verbal greetings that are designed to connect in a pleasant way with people. We cook meals for people. We do touch them in ways that nourish. So very often it takes a while before people can answer this question, but then they get something in mind that they've done for somebody in the last 24 hours. Now I say, focus your attention on how you think that enriched their life in terms of their needs. What needs of theirs were met? How do you think that left them feeling? And when people start to imagine that, you can see a beam come out in their face and their eyes. And I say, how do you feel right now when you realize that you did something that had that impact on people? And people say, oh, I feel good. I feel happy. I feel delighted. Then I ask them this question. Do any of you know anything that's more fulfilling than to do that? To use the power we have in a way that contributes to people's well-being. And I've asked that question all over the planet, and nobody has ever said to me, yeah, if you get a Lexus, that's better, or if you, you know, if you get these kind of culturally induced rewards, that's better. No, people say the most fulfilling thing is to contribute to people's well-being. Well, that's play, then. That's the most enjoyable play that we human beings engage in, to contribute to people's well-being. Now, sometimes that play can involve hard work, because I may work very hard to do something that contributes to people's well-being. Sometimes I travel a long way across the world to offer something to people that's enriched my life. But it's play when my full focus of attention is on why I'm doing it. I'm not doing it for money. I'm not doing it to get a positive report card. I'm doing it because something that has increased joy in my life, it's joyful to share it with others. It's a fun game. It's the most fun game I've ever found, contributing to people's well-being. I'm really confident it's the most fulfilling game we human beings will ever find. So Teilhard Chardin sees a rapid evolution. He just sees this last 8,000 years is just a temporary snag in our evolution, where some things led us to get culturally ignorant and to get involved in violence and competition. And he says it's just an evolutionary phenomenon, and he sees a rapid movement back to the more natural consciousness. Well, I agree with him that it's happening, and I think it's rapid, but my not being a paleontologist, I don't think in terms of tens of thousands of years. I have a granddaughter. I would like to see us speed it up. We're living on a planet where we have enough resources to meet everybody's needs. We have enough food so that it isn't necessary for millions to starve. We have the medicines that could be preventing millions from dying of diseases. So it's only the consciousness that we need to alter. And there is a rapid movement toward the evolution of this consciousness. I just want us to do it faster.